Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mona, when I talk to other people about podcasting and that I do a podcast, they ask me, well, what topic do you do? And when I mention EB5, they ask me, what? And I explain them the EB5 market and how it's such a niche market and niche industry. And we've done about 100 episodes. It surprises a lot of people. It's a shrinking market, but I think it's also pretty focused.
It is shrinking, Mark. And yes, we've done 100 podcasts. And quite frankly, we can easily do another 300 with the topics and the areas, because interestingly, one topic might have 15 different outlooks. And you've heard it yourself. We've asked the same developer the same question, and we've had so many different interpretations. Mm-hmm. That's with any area of law, but EB5 itself, because of it, the complex nature of EB5, the fact that we're talking business, corporate, investment, immigration, politics, they're really, really, there's a lot involved. And you're right, there's not a lot of resources. Market is shrinking. As we can see, the market itself has shrunk. However, I would say, and I would argue, that some of the resources that we have out there now are better than ever.
That's right, Mona. And today we're going to be talking about one of those new resources, specifically the EB5 Marketplace. And with that, allow me to introduce you all to Kurt Royce. Kurt is the president of EB5 Marketplace, a platform of EB5 investments, which includes due diligence, site visit videos, strength and risk analysis, as well as deal ratings. Kurt has moderated the influential EB5 Securities Roundtable since 2016 and the EB5 Immigration Lawyers Roundtable since 2018. Kurt was the host of a biweekly EB5 webinar series from 2015 to 2017, which covered securities matters as they relate to the EB5 immigration program. Now, in 2020, he joins us on EB5 Investment Voice. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Kurt, it's great to have you here. One of the main reasons we wanted you here is because, as we all know, EB5 has gone through some changes, not so huge, but very significant. And the significance has been to completely change the overall marketplace.
Yes, it has. The change of investment amounts certainly has been nervous for a lot of people as to whether or not investors would be willing to essentially spend $1 million as opposed to $500,000. But the much bigger change has been the fact that by changing the way projects are defined as being available at the lower investment amount, most projects won't qualify at the $1 million amount. They'll be at the $1.8 million amount. And I say $1 million because it's a $900,000 investment. But when you add in your immigration attorney's fees and your filing fees and your administration fee, you're probably at about $1 million. So it's a contraction of the number of investments that are actually available at that $1 million level, in addition to this doubling of the investment amount.
You're right, Kurt. However, what we have seen since November is that we are still getting quite a lot of response from investors who have the ability to be able to invest, but they are confused as to what is out there in the marketplace, what is a good investment, because they're hearing so many conflicting informations. One of the initial points that I just brought up with Mark was the fact that there are very few resources for news and updates. So I do know that you do run a weekly newsletter, EB5 Weekly, I believe.
That's correct.
And on that newsletter, do you yourself write the articles or get the information? How do you update your information?
Well, I am pretty familiar with a lot of the people in the industry. I have the benefit of having relationships with a lot of people. So I know what's typically getting published. And in addition to that, we have subscriptions to a number of news outlets. So what we do on a weekly basis is we review all of the news stories that are coming out. We determine what we think are the most pertinent. And then we'll write a one paragraph abbreviated summary of the story and then provide a link to the story. So with one weekly newsletter, we're trying to give the industry an easy way to digest whatever is coming out in the news that week.
Well, that's a great idea because you do actually bring in the scandal also, I believe, and you don't just keep it to, the mundane legislative changes, for example.
You know, there is unfortunately a fair amount of fraud in the industry historically. And I think the adage of, bad news brings more attention than good news. So we do cover a lot of stories on JPEG and the continuing saga of that project. And we do still see a lot of fraud cases involving the Chinese investors. But it's not really what I like to focus on. I'm really much more interested in where this industry is at. What are we doing to improve it? What are various people doing in the industry to make this something that investors can feel confident that they're going to get exactly what they're bargaining for, which is they're going to get their immigration benefits and they're going to get the timely return of their capital.
Well, I agree. And I do like to focus on the positive too. But I do have to ask, how do you source your authenticity of the articles? What are your quality controls? Because at the end of the day, you are printing, publishing, and it is considered a source.
I know the people that are writing the articles. I have some familiarity with the subject matter. So the role of the newsletter is essentially to aggregate the EB5 news of the week, to write a summary that allows industry stakeholders to quickly get that information, and then to click through to the articles that interest them. There's not a lot of the articles that, for example, there are some people who have perspectives that I may not agree with, but they are perspectives. And if I think that they are insightful, if I think that they are people who may be right, then it's an article that I would find to be worth publishing.
Well, there are only a handful of blogs, really, where they do comment on a day-to-day basis, or rather on a timely basis. But just generally, industry networking events are already down in number and definitely in the size of attendance, which is a trend I believe it's going to continue and accelerate. So that's going to change a lot of the networking structure and perhaps a lot of the outlets.
I don't know about that. My sense is that we are in a pause right now. We're all trying to digest the fact that not only have the rules changed, but we're still in the midst of questions as to whether or not there's new legislation on the horizon, how legitimate can something get done in this political environment. There was a lawsuit recently about the new regs and whether or not they were done appropriately.
Yeah, we've discussed that quite a lot on this podcast, yes.
So I think there's still a digestion of moving from version 1.0 to version 2.0 of EB5 is the way I see it. I see a wholesale change of this industry, and I think it's going to be, in the long term, I think it's going to be a much better industry, not so much focused on big real estate projects, and certainly not focused on big real estate projects in major urban markets, but I think we're going to have a broad sense of investments with various rates of return, various opportunities for investors, and I think that the internet was never a big part of people's ability to evaluate their EB5 investment options. And that had a lot to do with the fact that this program started in China and was controlled by the Chinese agents who controlled the information. And in my case, I noticed that the website that we had put together in 2013, it would take a minute and a half to load in China.
If it even was allowed to come up in China, because that was the other big issue. So many websites were blocked.
Right. So for many years, not only did they control the information, but most of the stakeholders in industry were familiar with that market. That was the market they had built their business on.
Yeah.
So building a marketplace, a digital marketplace, really didn't have much desire in the industry. Now, when the Indians got involved, that began to change.
Right, right. So that's what we are seeing now. We are seeing these large structural changes in the market and the fact that we are concentrated in fewer countries. And most of these countries are English-speaking countries who are more internet savvy, one being the Indians.
Right. Not only are they savvy investors, they wanted a rate of return that was reasonable, commensurate with the risk they were taking. Unfortunately, their introduction into the market happened so quickly that they were left with the investments because EB-5 takes so long to bring an offering to market, the Indians were essentially left with what investments were developed with the Chinese market in mind. So, and those were typically big real estate projects with marquee names and marquee locations and rates of return that were typically sub 1%. So this was a very frustrating environment for the Indians, but November 21 deadline of $500,000 did drive a lot of them to making a decision that this is the best option I have for my immigration benefits in this particular time frame.
Well, I do sort of like to differ here because I don't believe that that's the entire case, because first of all, we deal with more than just real estate. And I don't believe that everything was just real estate out there. And there are many projects which had not just real estate. So going back to your point about being on the internet, I agree. The internet hasn't been utilized, but there's a lot of negativity on the internet, which really doesn't explain some of the nuances within a project. So I'm not that big a fan of just having your project on the internet only.
Where do you think is the best place to have an investment?
Well, I do believe I'm old-fashioned. Go and visit the project. You speak with your developers, if you have access to the developers, that is. And I do believe that you should not just focus on the internet. And I understand that, you know, your EB-5 marketplace is based on the internet, and I'm ready to argue with you.
Wouldn't that make it a good, efficient first step, though, Mona?
I don't disagree with anything you just said, Mona. I think you're right. I think that in order to make a digital platform effective, these investments can't just be presented with some basic terms or some brochures. Significant due diligence needs to be provided on these investments, which does include a site visit. It does include meeting with management to understand any kind of nuances of the offering that are not clear in the offering documents. So I don't think there's anything that you've said that I disagree with.
Well, we've seen it, Kurt. We've seen it over and over again. We've seen how just a bad post, and it could be totally malicious, can hurt a project, which is just untrue. So definitely the digital platform is a fine introduction, but that's where it should stop. It should only be an introduction. But tell us a little bit about EB-5 Marketplace.
So EB-5 Marketplace, every investment on EB-5 Marketplace has been thoroughly due diligenced by a third-party due diligence firm, which is EB-5 Diligence, of which I was a original founder of that firm, along with my wife, Rupi Chima. I'm not involved any longer in the day-to-day operations, but every investment that I put on the EB-5 Marketplace first has to have a full due diligence conducted on it. And that does include a site visit, background checks on all the principals, both of the JCE, the production, the development company, as well as of the new commercial enterprise, the people who are managing your money.
Actually, Kurt, I believe that Rupi has been a speaker on one of our podcasts quite some time ago. Do you recall, Mark?
I believe that was the best podcast I had ever heard. So, you know, due diligence has to be thorough, and anything less than thorough is probably worse than nothing, because if you start to believe in the fact that this project has been properly diligenced and it's only getting a cursory due diligence, I think that can be really disturbing to an investor. So I think the opportunity with the marketplace is that not only is every investment due diligenced, but all of the deal terms are easy to compare because they're organized in the same fashion. So if you want to look at 6 or 7 investments, you can quickly understand, okay, what's the investment amount? What's the administration fee? What are the terms of exit strategy? What are the back, you know, I can look at the background checks. I can look at each one of these aspects of a deal and compare them fairly quickly. So that's the power of the internet to me.
Well, yes, but that is also projects that you have managed to put in the EB-5 marketplace. There are hundreds and hundreds of projects which are not on there. And I do believe that most of your projects are real estate projects, Kurt. And there are a lot of non-real estate projects out in the marketplace.
You know, I'm not aware of a lot of real estate projects in the market, non-real estate projects in the marketplace today, but I do believe that that's where we're headed. I believe that we are going into a completely new realm where I believe we're even going to see smaller venture capital backed projects,
right,
where small entities are cash flow positive. They've proven their concept. They're ready to grow with some smart VC money, and they want to add jobs. And the EB-5 program could be a very effective way for those venture capitalists to invite some less expensive capital, at the same time giving those investors an opportunity to earn reasonable rates of return on their investment, especially if they're ahead of the equity partners. So it seems to me like we're coming into a new world, and I think that I'm only going to see the EB-5 marketplace become what I hope it will be if we cover a diversity of industries, if we cover a diversity of rates of return.
Here we have something. So I would love to question you about this, because you're someone who has been out in the industry and you do know what the rate of returns and the agent costs have been. So typically, pre the Indians coming in, and it was more of the China market, we were seeing huge agent costs and almost no ROI to investors. Then suddenly, last year, we were seeing zero agent costs because investors were coming directly to projects and ridiculously inflated ROI to investors. It seems like, you know, we need to find this happy medium so that we can at least have a realistic idea that the investors aren't going to get not only a return, but they're going to get a return of their capital also.
Well, certainly towards the end of the $500,000 investment amount, we did see an inflation of the willingness for projects to take what they could, because they knew that if they didn't raise their money by November 21st, they were going to have to exit EB-5 anyway. So, and you're right, the industry was willing to go directly to these investments and make deals in order to cut down their costs, their administration fee costs. I think it was a moment in time where investors had the benefit of having a strong negotiating position and issuers had a weak position. I still think investors weren't effectively served because a lot of them really didn't have enough information to make decisions as to what the best investment were.
Yeah, we're hearing about this now. Yeah.
Well, I think that now that we're post, let's say 2019, we're still in a development stage. People are exiting the market. Other people are trying to figure out whether or not they need to spend some of their time at EB-5. I noticed that a lot of securities attorneys are considering now maybe spending more time on opportunity zones. Others are moving into some other areas. So we're going to see a dilution of the attention span for a little while because we all have to make a living.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's a really exciting time. And we're going to, I think, bring businesses into the fold that didn't really have a chance to compete with marquee projects, certainly didn't have the ability to travel around the world looking for investors, offering agents the, as you said, excessive fees that they were charging in order to get an audience with their investors. And I hope that the EB-5 marketplace is a transparent, cost-effective way for people to compare their options. And if it does become effective and if it does become efficient, I think we'll bring a lot of very interesting businesses into the EB-5 world and offer investors opportunities that they've never seen before.
Yep, I'd like to see that. We're already getting those kind of inquiries. Quick question, Kurt. Prior to November 21, the typical administrative fee was anywhere between 55 and 65,000. Now that we're seeing 900 plus, are you seeing an administrative fee of 90,000 with agents demanding a whole 90,000 fee plus back end points?
Well, I don't see agents demanding anything yet because very few people have been able to get investors to a point where they're ready to sign.
Well, I actually have seen this. I mean, I've already heard from, we've heard these demands from Korean agents as well as Vietnamese agents who are demanding 90,000 plus back end points. We balked at that. We thought that was way too high for the market.
You're probably getting a better perspective on what agents are doing overseas than I do. It's just not something that I have a lot of insight in. But as far as what I'm seeing from issuers, I have seen $90,000 admin fees, but typically when they're offering a $1.8 million investment, the admin fee on a $900,000 investment seems to be in the neighborhood of about $70,000 right now. Now, certainly we could see some agents overseas balking, but I don't think the agents are going to control the market the way they used to. And I think that if issuers were to come in at $70,000, ultimately the market would end up somewhere around there.
All right. And I think it also will depend very much on what the ROI is. So again, I'm going to ask you what you are seeing in the market right now as to the ROI to investors. We're not really seeing the traditional 0.5% to 2% returns. We have noticed a number of ridiculous ones. Again, I'll say ridiculous because 6 to 12% is not EB5 compatible. That may be private equity, but we don't see the numbers really being able to manage. And we are advising more on the 4 to 5%.
Well, I have a different perspective on it. I see a bifurcated market. I see one level of the market, which is still going to be at that almost no return, 1% rate of return, but a tremendous position in the capital stack with great security interest, with a project that's made advanced strides towards development, where an investor really just wants to make his investment and he wants to know that he's going to get his money back and the rate of return is not an issue. And I think that's going to be, it could be half of the market, I think, could end up in that genre. And I think the other side of the market is going to be between, let's say, 3 or 4% and as much as 12 to 15%. I'm seeing deals that in that 8 to 12% range that I think are solid deals. They're more confusing. You're going to have to believe in the model behind it. You're also going to see oil and gas and solar energy coming into the market. And those investors are willing to pay above 10% to investors to get them in because the rates of return can be very high, but the risk can be very high as well. To me, the critical aspect is make sure that whatever investment you select, you have a high degree of confidence in the immigration benefits, number one. And then number two, if you believe with confidence that the jobs will be created and that your money will be maintained at risk for the duration of your investment, and you're dealing with professionals, people that know what they're doing in EB-5, to me, that's the immigration aspect of it. Then you can pick a project based on what your personal needs are as far as either rates of return or what industry you're comfortable with, or, you know, there's a various number of aspects that you might find of interest, and who knows where those rates of return are going to come in.
But Kurt, what you have said really does contradict itself. We are talking about an investment at risk and no guarantee. Are you talking about a low-risk investment as opposed to a high-risk? And what kind of project would you put there as an example?
So the at-risk component of EB-5 means that the investor's money must be at risk. Interestingly, once you make an investment in new commercial enterprise, that new commercial enterprise can actually enter into what could look to a lot of people like almost no risk. And an example of that is this deal is no longer available. But I won't get into the specifics of it, but it was a large building that had been 100% leased out on a 30-year lease, and it was 65% complete, and the developer was a multi-billion dollar developer, and they put up a personal guarantee that they would repay anyone at any time, whether they got their EB-5 petition denied, or they guaranteed that they would get their money paid back, the loan would be paid back to the NCE, I should say.
Yeah, I was going to jump in that you had to be very careful. The minute you say the word personal guarantee, that's just not allowed.
Well, it is. This was a personal guarantee from the developer to the fund, the NCE, the new commercial enterprise, the fund that the investor had invested in. So that's allowed. You're allowed to make a personal guarantee to the fund, but the fund cannot make a personal guarantee back to the investor. So there's where the risk was maintained. So imagine that this developer with a $2 billion balance sheet now has a guarantee back to the fund, but the fund, for whatever reason, doesn't pay that investor back. Well, that's the risk. That was the total risk that I could see in this project. So yes, I understand that investments must be at risk from the investor's point of view, but if you invest in a fund, in a new commercial enterprise that has entered into an agreement with a very deep-pocketed developer that's willing to put their money at risk in a guarantee, then you've actually covered your at-risk provision.
Well, I think that's a topic we can discuss in a different podcast. The problem I often have with due diligence sites or due diligence services like EB-5 Marketplace is the fact that they are not necessarily industry experts in every area. Yes, they may cover real estate, but not the other areas. And as you correctly mentioned just now, we are seeing so many more industries entering in EB-5. What do you do in situations like that?
Well, I would say that, first of all, EB-5 marketplace is overseen by a broker-dealer firm. And broker-dealers are, their role is typically to bring offerings to market in various industries. In our case, we, again, rely on the CPAs, the analysts of EB-5 diligence, and they don't need to be industry experts, but they do have to have access to industry metrics in order to test the reasonableness of the financial models that they're evaluating.
Well, perhaps you could explain that again. What are industry metrics?
Industry metrics would mean if you are looking at a hotel, then you want to make sure that you understand the metrics of what makes a hotel profitable. If you're looking at, let's say, a new technology and they're projecting financial forecasts, financial pro formas about what they can accomplish, you're going to look at what have they accomplished to date, and you might be looking at other participants in the industry to see what they've been able to accomplish. So you're basically doing the same kind of financial analysis that any investor would do.
So, Kurt, what you're saying is the key operating parameters or the key operating metrics may be different from industry to industry, like occupancy rates for real estate like hotels or inventory turnover rates for other relevant industries. It's really the job of the CPAs to know what 2, 3, maybe 5 financial metrics are important to that one and then measure across those in that industry.
That's right, Mark. When it comes to due diligence on EB-5 projects, you've obviously got a number of things. Like, you wanted to verify that all material agreements have been entered. So you want to review those. You want to do background checks. You want to discuss exit strategies. You want to discuss immigration aspects. And then when it comes to the industry itself, you want to be able to look at the market feasibility study. And you also want to be able to do a sensitivity analysis. So you want to know, okay, if they hit their benchmarks, if they hit the projections, then this is where we're at. But what if they were to come up short? And how short do they have to come before they start to not be able to meet their projections and not to be able to make payments back to the NCE in this case? So,
for example, like a 10% variance on one of their key operating parameters, if that results in like an 80 or 90% variance on the risk, that'd be extremely sensitive and probably pretty
risky. Extremely sensitive. That's right.
So, Mona, I know when you and I were talking at the top of the show, really what we were kind of getting at is, are digital platforms effective? And you kind of mentioned yourself, you know, investors need to go out and they need to look at and check out the project. And I know that the EB-5 marketplace has these videos and these risk analysis. And
I agree, Mark. I will stand by the fact that, unfortunately, with the internet today, we have been prone to so-called fake news, and there may be a rival project which has put something negative about the project that you're looking at. And it's very difficult to just judge by the internet alone. But the wonderful thing about EB-5 Marketplace is that you're not just dealing with the internet. You are dealing with a live person. Correct, Kurt?
Well, certainly you're dealing with a registered broker-dealer. So the marketplace is a tool that people use. Just to give you a genesis of how it began, when I used to try to serve my clients, I would typically give them 3 or 4 due diligence reports. And these reports were about 30 to 40 pages. And this is a distillation, remember, of all of the offering documents. It had references to the regional center's designation letter. It had references to the market feasibility study, to the employment studies. So all of this was distilled down to 40 pages. And I figured with 3 or 4 of these reports, investors are going to feel very empowered to make a smart decision. And what I discovered was they weren't even reading those reports. And so the marketplace came about because I realized that I needed to even simplify it further. And so what we've done is we've migrated most of the major terms into a digital format so that now people can jump from term to term and from deal to deal and make comparisons. And when it comes to the site visit, we record a site visit video so people can see where the project is as we're visiting it. So I don't disagree that it's nice for an investor to visit a project, but I also think that you can eliminate a lot of the confusion and the noise out there, and you can really focus in on 1 or 2 projects using a digital marketplace.
So while we all can agree that physically going to a project can be advantageous, when we ask ourselves, are digital platforms effective? I think the answer really is digital platforms certainly are efficient. As you said, we can use these tools such as EB5 Marketplace to compare those terms across deal to deal and even see those walkthrough videos. And that certainly does sound convenient. And so, Kurt Royce, thank you for making it convenient for all of us and all of our listeners by coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mona.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.